Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's episode is titled, Retooling Energy Regulations, Who Decides? My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Tony Clark, a senior advisor at Wilkinson, Barker, and Auer, and former FERC commissioner, Travis Cavula, a vice president for regulatory affairs at NRG Energy and former commissioner at the Montana Public Service Commission, and moderating is Adam Griffin, a constitutional law fellow at the Institute for Justice. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Adam, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks to everyone for being on this call today. We have two excellent speakers on today's Teleforum to discuss an important new rulemaking from FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The final rule revises the Commission's regulations implementing the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act of 1978, or PURPA. PURPA was enacted under the Carter administration to reduce demand for traditional fossil fuels by encouraging the development of small power producers and cogenerators called qualifying facilities, or QFs. This occurred by placing certain requirements on utilities for how they had to treat QFs entering the market, including mandating they enter into certain contracts to buy QFs energy, as well as to buy QFs capacity. Capacity is the in the industry is the ability to produce energy when in greatest demand. Yet, as regulation-mandated PURPA contracts expanded, many utilities and ultimately ratepayers became saddled with expensive power contracts that overcharged for energy. The new rule's stated purpose is to better align those regulations with the modern energy landscape while continuing to encourage development of qualifying facilities called QFs. A quick rundown of the major changes, and then I'll turn it over to our speakers. The new rule allows states to approve contracts between utilities and QFs that have variable energy compensation rates. The old rule required fixed rates for energy during the life of the contract. The new rule also allowed state regulators to use competitive solicitations to set QF rates for both energy and capacity instead of relying on administrative pricing. The new rule requires utilities to purchase from QFs that generate 5 megawatts of power or less in the regional wholesale markets that exist in two-thirds of the United States. This is a reduction from the old rule, which required utilities to purchase from QFs that generated 20 megawatts of power or less. The new rule also modifies PURPA's one-mile rule. The one-mile rule determines whether separate facilities are considered to be the same site. If facilities are within 1 mile of each other, they are a single facility. If facilities are more than 1 mile apart but less than 10 miles apart, then parties can contest and prove that they are still a single facility. Facilities 10 miles apart or more are separate facilities. The new rule also requires states to create criteria that a QF must satisfy before it is entitled to contract to a contract or legally enforceable obligation with a utility. Finally, the new rule allows an entity to freely protest the certification or recertification of a QF, where the old rule charged entities $50,000 to do so. To provide insights into the new rule, its implications and impacts, the Federalist Society is pleased to host two energy law experts. First, we will hear from Tony Clark. Mr. Clark is a senior advisor at Wilkinson, Barker, Nauer, LLP. He is a former FERC commissioner, a chairman and commissioner of the North Dakota Public Service Commission, a former president of the National Association of Regulatory Utilities Commissioners, a former labor commissioner of North Dakota, and member of the North Dakota House of Representatives. Mr. Clark is a recognized thought leader in the world of energy law, and we are grateful that he joins us today to provide his insights on FERC's new PURPA rulemaking. After Mr. Clark, we will hear from Travis Cavula. Mr. Cavula is the Vice President for Regulatory Affairs at NRG Energy, Inc. Mr. Cavula previously headed up energy and environmental policy for the R Street Institute, a pro-liberty think tank, and before that was twice elected to public office as a utility commissioner in Montana. Mr. Cavulla has also held leadership roles in national policy circles, including as president of the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners and a co-author of NARUC's White Paper on PURPA Reform. Thank you, Mr. Clark and Mr. Cavulla, for being here today. I'll turn it over to Mr. Clark to begin.
Well, thank you, Adam, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this timely topic and an important one in the energy world. Just a couple of opening comments on the PURPA rulemaking and things to consider in why FERC did what it did, and then we'll look forward to hearing from Travis and engaging in some Q&A. First of all, it's worth noting that in terms of FERC's ability to shape PURPA, there are some limitations around it, which is that, as we all know, as an administrative agency, it still has to live within the statute itself. So some of the concerns that you sometimes hear from state regulators or utilities or consumer groups about how PURPA was working or being enacted, or really even the original intent of PURPA, is really embedded in the statute itself. So FERC's ability to shape it around the edges is limited, understandably, by the statute itself. But having said that, the commission does have a fair amount of discretion to ensure that it's implemented along statutory guidelines, but in a way that works given the energy marketplace as it is. And the Act itself envisions the commission from time to time doing exactly what it did here. Now, this is a long-term process. The opening of the rulemaking and the gathering of the information started back, I think, as far as 2015. It was while I was on the commission, and we had some initial fact-finding technical workshops at that point. And it was really the culmination of hearing, probably for the last 10 or 15 years, from a lot of states that were having a great deal of concern about PURPA and what the impact was on consumers. And in some ways, I think there has always been a little bit of a disconnect between how people perceive PURPA in certain regions of the country and in other regions of the country. And it really breaks down along a few lines. And I'll when I talk about this disconnect, I'll give you an example of just my own working career and the different perspectives that I had on PURPA throughout my time in regulatory agencies. I spent about 11 and a half years on the North Dakota State Commission and about 4.5 years on FERC. Now, North Dakota is an upper Midwest / somewhat western state that has vertically integrated utilities, but it's a state that all of the vertically integrated utilities are within an organized RTO. So when you combine the fact that the investor-owned utilities were within an RTO and a lot of the just geographic base of the state was in non-jurisdictional co-ops, you really didn't have that many PURPA projects that were being developed there. And that is the case in a lot of parts of the country. And so in my time as a state commissioner, I really didn't hear that many PURPA cases. Every so often with our utilities, we would set the avoided costs, but it was kind of a proceeding that didn't have a huge impact on consumers because there just weren't that many projects that were out there. When I got to FERC, I started hearing a lot about PURPA, especially from states to the west of North Dakota. So the PURPA issue is an especially big issue in parts of the southeast and in much of the west where the utilities are in bilateral markets and not in organized markets. And in these states, the impact that PURPA was having was dramatic, and we were hearing directly from state commissioners. I'll give you two examples that I think are instructive of utilities that have faced a lot of issues with PURPA. One's Idaho and Idaho Power, and one is Northwestern, at least in terms of its Montana jurisdiction. To give you an idea of the impact, and I think, again, people in other parts of the country may not quite appreciate how big an impact it is. Idaho Power, it's got under 600,000 electric customers. When you total up customer obligations for all PURPA generation projects, it's about $3.3 billion for those 700,000 roughly customers. PURPA generation contracts have averaged about 14% of Idaho Power's total generation, but 33% of their annual generation costs the last 5 years. And on average, those PURPA projects were costing something like 2 to 3 times higher than any other system resources. But nonetheless, because it was a statutory obligation, and because of the way the pricing rules that FERC had established, this was the net result in Idaho. Turning to Montana, and in the spirit of full disclosure, I serve as a member of the board of directors of Northwestern Energy, which is the largest IOU in the state of Montana. But if you look at, this is as of last year, so this data is probably a little bit changed, but as of last year, if all of the PURPA projects that were proposed were to come online by 2022, that would be about 1,245 megawatts just from PURPA projects. In comparison, Northwestern's total rate-based assets are under 900 megawatts, and the average retail load in the entire state is about 750 megawatts, which gives you an example of an idea of the magnitude that this has. But here's the kicker, and this is the real issue. Northwestern has a capacity deficit of about 645 megawatts. In other words, there's a lot of energy at given points during the day, but in terms of actual deliverable capacity, there's actually a shortfall. But all of those PURPA projects that are proposed do very little to accomplish anything in terms of alleviating that capacity shortfall. So when you look at the magnitude of the problem in some of these oftentimes smaller states, I would argue that if you had a proportional cost problem as big as this, say in the heart of PJM, I think it would have been an all hands on deck. The house is burning down. FERC has to deal with this issue immediately. If it had happened in a part of the country that just gets more visibility on some of these issues, I think because it was happening out in flyover country, it probably languished a little bit. But I'm very glad that the commission addressed it. And I think in most ways, did a pretty good job of trying to coordinate the requirements of the statute with the rulemaking flexibility that it had. What it does is, I think, and it helps correct some of the myths, I think, that sometimes exist about PURPA. Two of the biggest ones being that PURPA is necessarily always good for the environment and promotes just clean energy projects. And the second is that PURPA necessarily injects competition and therefore cost savings for consumers. As to the first point, one of the sort of interesting things, taking again, for example, the Montana situation, PURPA projects aren't necessarily just renewable projects. In the case of the Montana system, there are two projects called KELP and YELP, Colstrip Energy Limited Partnership and Yellowstone Energy Limited Partnership. These are qualifying facilities under the statute and are contracted and have been for a long, long time. One is a waste coal generator. One is a waste pet coke generator. They produce about 11% of the energy on the Montana system, and they produce about 37% of the CO2 emissions on the Montana system. So I think we should disabuse ourselves of the notion that PURPA is always something that promotes clean, renewable projects. And they're probably two of the largest for certain QFs on the system. In terms of cost savings and competition, oftentimes I think PURPA has in some ways undercut competition. And I think Nehruk did a white paper that Travis was heavily involved in. He can probably speak to it a bit more, but I think it lays out this case very well. And what it deals with is the ability to sort of use the statute and use the rules that implementing the statute in ways that undercut competitive pricing. The record suggests, and Commissioner McNamee in his concurrence on the order adopting the rulemaking pointed out that the record suggests that somewhere between $2.2 billion to $3.9 billion in electricity costs were probably overpaid by customers in relation to what they would have had to pay in a more competitive environment, simply because of the mandate and PURPA being used as this cudgel, basically. In response to that, state commissions were really pulling their hair out trying to figure out how to get some relief for consumers. Because FERC's rules didn't have a lot of flexibility built into them, unfortunately, I think we'll have much more flexibility now moving forward. The one tool the state commissions were looking at was shortening contracts. That's not good for the QF developer, but it did offer some potential help for customers, and that was one of the things that states were trying to do to alleviate it. Again, as Commissioner McNamee pointed out in his concurrence, I think you can make a reasonable argument that actually the mandates of the statute are better for developers if they can receive some longer-term contracts than in relation to what was happening, which is really just an attempt by state commissions to protect their own consumers. So with that, I'll wrap up my introductory comments. As I said, I think in the broad strokes, the commission generally got it right. We'll talk about in Q&A a little bit more about what they got more right than maybe some missed opportunities in other areas. But I think it can be safely said that, that, at least in my opinion, the commission did a good job of refreshing the rules in a way that continues to support the statute, but gives consumers and state commissions more flexibility to implement the statute in ways that make sense given today's electricity marketplace.
Thank you, Travis.
Go ahead, Travis. I was getting ready.
Oh, thanks. All right. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Tony. Thanks to the Federalist Society as well. Thanks for tackling a topic on energy regulation that you don't often hear about, but which, as Tony says, is really important to anywhere between about a dozen to 20 states that are not part of one of these organized markets. And I thought I'd back up and talk a little bit about the core legal mandates of purpose, so those red lines in the statute that FERC can't cross, and then connect it back to what we see in terms of FERC's rulemaking and why the situation that Tony describes has been precipitated by a statute that appears to seem competitively neutral, not really geared to producing excess costs, but which nevertheless I think has the evidence pretty clearly demonstrates. So two core legal mandates in PURPA. First, that state regulators can't discriminate in the rates they pay to qualifying facilities as QFs, as they're known under PURPA, and the rates that those state regulators authorize for utilities themselves for the energy and capacity their power plants provide the system. And second, that rates paid to QFs need to be set on so-called avoided costs, what utilities would otherwise pay if the QFs were not online. Again, good principles. And to add to that, that those are core mandates out of the 1978 statutory enactment. And then the situation, the sort of bifurcation that Tony described came about as a result of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, where Congress sort of surgically said that there could be relief from the mandatory purchase obligation under PURPA if the QFs weren't trapped behind the gates of utility monopolies. So where they do participate in these regionally organized wholesale markets, in RTOs, in other words, and if anyone is unclear about what's an RTO and what's not, just go onto your favorite search engine and type RTO, and you'll see a colorful map displaying where they exist and where they don't. But in the places on such a map where color exists, PURPA really is a non-issue, except for certain cogeneration facilities, typically. But elsewhere, as Tony describes, it has been a big issue. So going to how state regulators have implemented PURPA in those states where it is a big issue, I think it's important to really consider that since discrimination is the key legal mandate that is avoiding it, that we need to consider how utilities themselves make money on energy and capacity, to consider how then in practice QFs end up being paid for their production. And a utility's capital investment is what utility regulators call rate base. And this figure is based on the actual cost typically to the utility to buy or build a power plant, but it's justified to regulators on assertions that the utility generator's capacity and energy will be in the money over the long term compared to other possible investments, including buying energy from third-party sources or from the open market. Once those investments are approved by regulators, the risk of that guesswork is largely shifted away from utilities in the regions that we're talking about and onto consumers. If a utility makes an investment in year zero and by year 10 it turns out to be a total dud, the financial consequences of that, sad to say, are not shouldered by the utility and its shareholders typically. They're instead shouldered by customers. Add to that the fact that utilities tend to be paid a return on equity in most U.S. jurisdictions that exceeds their actual cost of capital. In any case, it's well above the average of utility regulation in OECD countries. An incentive exists in utility regulation to sort of spend more and make more, to always be presenting forecasts of energy and capacity that make higher priced investments or building your own power plant look favored. So PURPA, as imagined by its proponents at the time of adoption, was supposed to introduce competition to constrain this particular perverse incentive that I'm talking about, in addition to diversifying sources of supply so that we weren't just relying especially on foreign oil, but even on just domestic sources of supply that were uniform like coal. Unfortunately, it really has not turned out to work that way. And the problem, the fundamental problem here, is that PURPA hasn't been implemented to rely on head-to-head competition with utility-owned generators, which might drive prices down, and which is how power auctions work in the RTO competitive regions that we've been talking about. Instead, QFs tend to use utilities' own avoided cost forecasts, making certain adjustments to them themselves with some regulatory intervention. As I've just mentioned, those forecasts tend to be used to justify utilities' own investments. So in other words, they tend to aim pretty high. So to date, to try to put a fine point on this, PURPA implementation, even though it's often couched in the rubric of competitive markets, is really just kind of a weak Xerox effect of the worst parts of utility regulation. It's not competition in the sense of actually getting power plants to bid against one another. It's instead competition of the sense that says, hey, we give you utilities this sweet deal where we allow you to pad rate base, so we're going to turn it around and basically do the same thing for these third parties, who for a variety of reasons that I need not get into, are sometimes in an even better position to game the system using cost forecasting techniques. So again, it hasn't resulted in competition. It's just resulted in, I guess you could say, a type of competition that unfolds before regulatory agencies to procure administrative favors. And my goodness, when I was a state utility commissioner, that type of litigation practice abounded. I've said it publicly before that somewhere between a quarter to a half of my time, depending on the year as a regulator, was sitting playing referee in disputes between QF projects under PURPA and the utility and its consumers that were under an obligation to buy them at avoided cost. And each party would trot out their expert witnesses, you know, providing the quote unquote right price forecast for energy and capacity. And the person who ended up having to decide which forecast was right was me. A government and my colleagues, government officials, regulatory commissioners, who frankly, put aside our relative expertise or lack thereof, it was also just the fact that it was no skin off our teeth, or resultingly the QF's teeth, or even the utility's teeth, what price we authorized. Because once we had spoken and locked in a rate, all of the risk of forecast error, which was inevitable, transferred to consumers. And the funny thing happens when you're asking regulators to name the right price. If a regulator names a price that is too low for the QF to actually get built, well, it won't get built. And even though the regulator thinks they've done a good job at calling out the proper economic forecasting of the power sector, those benefits or that accuracy, one might say, is not going to redound to the benefit of consumers because the project simply won't come under contract and ultimately commercially operational. Whereas if a utility makes an error in the other side, is too generous with how they forecast prices for QFs, well, then the gold rush begins. And that's really what we've seen in practice in a lot of QF development across the country. And it's what drives the kind of excess costs that Tony has been talking about, and which I agree with. So in other words, despite the notion of that QFs are paid only at avoided cost, or that QF's rates are not discriminatory relative to utility rates, the practical effect of what I'm discussing always tends to err, it seems, on getting projects on the high side. So just a couple points about the good and not so good of the FERC rule before we open it up to discussion. First, I think the most positive part of what FERC has done in this rulemaking, which is really the first major rulemaking on PURPA since rules were implemented in 1982, is that it's said that utilities can set avoided cost using competitive solicitations. In other words, you can comply with PURPA not through looking into the glass ball, as I was just describing, but instead putting generators in competition with one another. Now, there's a lot of details in that. FERC adopted the so-called Allegheny standards to try to eliminate self-dealing opportunities or gaming on the part of utilities. I myself take a pretty strong position on this. I think personally, and my firm as well believes this, that probably we should have monopolies be no larger than they need to be in order to get their infrastructure done. I think it's hard to have a genuinely competitive generation market if you allow these monopolies to be entangled in what should be a competitive business. But putting that aside, it's important that FERC at least said competitive solicitations can be used to comply with PURPA and put some guideboards around it. Second, I'll call out as the sort of not so good element that the commission allowed states to set energy avoided costs on a variable basis rather than a fixed basis. And you may be saying, well, I thought you just said fixed-based energy pricing is wrong because the guesses are always wrong. I agree, and I think that would be a good thing were the situation to apply to utilities themselves. But FERC stopped short of requiring that to be a precondition of this form of PURPA implementation. FERC instead seems to be assuming that regulated utilities are subject to market price volatility in what they collect in revenue for energy output of their plants. And the reality is that they just aren't, at least not uniformly. If I build or buy a nuclear power plant like Southern Company is doing, or hydroelectric facilities like the company I regulated in Montana did, or wind and solar as a utility, I'm essentially locking in the price of energy from those utilities with the same kind of administrative guesswork we rightly criticize when it comes to PURPA implementation. And we've likewise seen long-term coal contracts and gas supply transactions. So even for facilities where fuel is a driver of energy costs, we've seen the same thing. Now, these deals might be good or bad or indifferent, but what they do is ensure that customer pricing doesn't end up bearing a direct relationship to changes in the marketplace, at least in situations that still have a monopoly and can pass along those costs to a captive set of consumers. So with that said, I generally view the FERC order as a well-reasoned piece of work. It runs about 500 pages long, not on the register, but on the PDF document. And I think pretty much everything FERC did in the order would be worthy of praise if it applied evenly to everyone. And even where they didn't, I think they've opened up some really meaningful opportunities for both customer savings as well as competitive neutrality in some important places. Again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Travis, and thank you, Tony. I'm going to give each of you a couple of minutes if you have any points that you want to comment on the other's presentation or any questions for the other one. So, Tony, if you'd like to start on that.
Sure. I just a couple of reactions, and this one probably isn't going to surprise Travis a whole lot because we've discussed these issues in the past. But on the, this was something that was, I think, discussed a little bit actually at the commission meeting upon adoption. If I remember, Commissioner Danley maybe spoke a little bit to this, and Commissioner Glick had commented on this. But it's the this question of that Travis had raised at the end about standards applying evenly to everyone. And I think this is really, it helps highlight in my mind some of the problems with PURPA, which is, in my mind, there is a significant difference between most PURPA projects and projects that are built within an integrated resource plan for utility. And they should be treated differently because they're not similarly situated. And this, when I say within an integrated resource plan, these could be projects either built, self-built by the utility and approved by the commission and built into rate base, or projects that were built by a third-party merchant developer and made it through a competitive solicitation process in an integrated resource plan. When a project is developed as part of a regulated asset or within a plan, it's serving some sort of specific need to provide 24/7 energy to consumers, hopefully on a least cost basis. And there are ways to interject competition into that process through things like RFPs. PURPA projects are very different, however. Because the statute is written sort of excluding need or location or all sorts of things that engineers who build these networks take a look at, it's a legal entitlement. And so whether the project is really in an optimal place on the transmission grid, whether it provides energy when the energy is most needed as opposed to when the wholesale markets are flooded with energy, all those things kind of go out the window. So in my mind, they're very much different projects, and for this reason, it's appropriate to treat them differently than those projects that are built as some sort of planned process within those states that have chosen to continue to have vertically integrated utilities. The second sort of reaction that I have, which is I think illustrative of some of the problems that can come out of PURPA as Travis talked about them, was this issue of once the PURPA put is there and the costs simply flow through to consumers, he's correct. At that point, consumers bear all of the costs of those. They just kind of flow through and may not directly impact the bottom line of the regulated utility, but there is an impact on the regulated utility, and I would argue consumers beyond just those costs of the project that may or may not be providing particularly valuable energy at the time that it provides it, which is all of those actions, when you look at some of these systems across the western or southeast part of the U.S., they incrementally add all of these costs on consumers. That creates a lot of rate pressure on consumers. And what it means is for the still regulated portions of the sort of traditionally regulated portion of the utility assets, maybe investments in grid modernization, distribution wires investments that position the grid in a way that's beneficial for the future. It gets tougher for the utility, the regulated utility, to make those investments because they're in a cost environment where the regulator is concerned, rightfully so, with the costs that consumers are paying. And all of that upward rate pressure makes it more difficult to make those investments that but for that rate pressure might be widely accepted by lots of stakeholders as being necessary for either reliability or market efficiency. So it does have a spillover effect into other aspects of the regulated utilities, and I think ultimately to consumers themselves.
I'll just take a brief opportunity to respond, and because I think Tony and I do amicably disagree on a couple of points in what he just said, although I think we agree on a lot of this stuff. I think where we disagree is how we view and whether we view the integrated resource plan that Tony talks about as being fundamentally different than the type of administrative price forecasting that happens for QFs. And I guess I don't see the same gradation of difference that Tony does. In an integrated resource plan, yes, there's one big Borg-like model that's considering system needs and running it by a bunch of anticipated, not actual, because you don't know it until it actually happens, anticipated cost data for the resources that are in the mix. But fundamentally, it still relies on the kind of regulatory command and active mandate by which those costs are ordered into rates, and where the risk of forecasting wrong, albeit perhaps through a more finely tuned central model, where that risk is still transferred onto the consumers if the bet turns out to be misplaced. And we have seen integrated resource plans that appear to bias certain technologies that might be more to the greater financial reward of regulated utilities for some of the reasons I talked about in my introductory comments. And so there's reasons to be skeptical of that. Now, that is different. I agree with Tony. It is different than the kind of ad hoc call and response litany of QF pricing litigation, where you're trying to use cost elements broken out of that integrated resource planning model to interact with open market prices to come up with a price forecast that's then delivered to an individual qualifying facility for the purpose of contracting. But at its core, both of those have in common the same big risk shift to consumers of guessing wrong. And that's really, frankly, what's missing in these parts of the country we're talking about, is the fact that generators need to wear more of the responsibility of having bet wrong. And that's where business models that require, you know, if I, in my company, go out on the basis of what I estimate market prices are going to be over the next 5, 10, 20 years, and I build a power generator in response to the market prices I anticipate, and I'm wrong, and my plant ends up being out of the money, well, that, you know, that's on me and my shareholders. And we've seen in the competitive markets a lot of power generators get wiped out into bankruptcy and insolvency by making those wrong bets. And those costs don't end up redounding to consumers. They end up falling on whoever the equity and debt holders are. There's a flip side, which is obviously you keep upside benefits as well if you bet wrong and then it turns out to be even better. But nevertheless, I think that type of regulatory model better assigns the risk we're talking about of trying to bet on prices to the right people, rather than expecting regulation to do it for you, which proves, I think, again and again, to be the wrong way of going about this.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks, Travis. Greg, do you want to open up the floor for questions? Do we have any in the queue?
Yeah, let's do that now. We'll now go to the first question.
Yes, good afternoon. Fascinating topic. I'm just curious if you gentlemen could respond the point or the argument that FERPA has kind of outlived its usefulness. It's kind of a solution in search of a problem now. I mean, a statute that was originally enacted to, you know, address the oil embargo of the 1970s and the ersatz energy crisis in an era in which we now are, you know, variously energy independent as a nation, in which many, if not all, markets offer your choice of power generator. If you want to pay more for your power because it's green or something like that, that's available. It seems like an artificial subsidy that's being created through this, and I realize there would need to be political will to change it, which may or may not be there to actually repeal it. But it just seems like FERPA and maybe FERC overall is kind of a dinosaur.
Yeah, this is Tony. I think the point is very well taken, and this really gets to a public policy question that is ultimately up to Congress. But I think you're exactly right. I mean, you have to really think back to the genesis of PURPA, which I may have made this comment in a, either made it in a statement or a speech somewhere while I was on the commission, or I made it in a separate statement. I can't remember, but we're now PURPA is closer in time to Pearl Harbor than we are to PURPA. It was a statute that came out of the 70s energy crisis and the Arab oil embargo, and it was a time in which the country was dealing with shortages and extreme price volatility in oil and gas prices. And so it was an attempt to, one, try to get away from those problems that were immediately occurring in the 70s energy crisis, but also as an attempt to interject some bits of competition into a regulatory regime which was very siloed at that point. And a lot has changed. You mentioned some of them in the question, including the emergence of markets in parts of the country. But even in parts of the country that are still both vertically integrated and outside of the organized markets, with things like Order 888, which guarantees open access to the transmission grid. I mean, which is something that wasn't even contemplated at the time that PURPA was put in there. So I think in many ways the statute itself is relatively dated, and it would make sense for the statute to be either significantly reformed or repealed. The viability of getting that done is very difficult in Congress, of course, assuming the filibuster remains after January. But so I think the question's a good one. FERC, within its authority, I think, did a good job of trying to modernize it, which it clearly does have at least that amount of authority. But if bigger changes were to be made, likely those are going to come through Congress. And it does bear mentioning and acknowledging that in EPACT 05, PURPA could have been repealed at that time. Congress chose not to, and in fact added some language in relation to what the obligations for utilities were going to be that were operating within the organized market. So it tipped its sort of hat to some of the things that had changed between 78 and 05. But nonetheless, I think the core of the question is a very good point.
Yeah, I generally agree. Two quick points on this. First, assuming congressional inaction, which is always a safe bet, it then leaves the question to regulators. Are you going to be a regulator who looks at the statute and says, God, this just does not make any sense anymore, and we're just going to try to minimize its effects because it is so senseless? Or do you look at it and say, there's enough wiggle room in the statutory language to allow this statute to be repurposed as a more meaningful catalyst for competition in the places that don't yet have a fuller measure of competition like some of the Eastern electricity markets do. And so I think there's a legitimate debate to be had there. And I think you can argue it in some sense both ways on statutory intent. It is one of these statutes. It's not as bare bones as the Federal Power Act itself, which, famously uses the language that all rates shall be just and reasonable, and any rate which is in any respect unjust or unreasonable is declared unlawful, which is sort of a high watermark, I think, of delegation to FERC to figure out what that means. But PURPA comes pretty close to that. Discrimination and avoided cost, as Tony said in the beginning, there's a lot of ways to fiddle around with those concepts within the four corners of the law. But, this is a question that keeps presenting itself to energy regulators and environmental regulators as they, try to regulate carbon dioxide through the Clean Air Act, a statute which clearly was not intended for it, but which CO2 can awkwardly be fit into. To the questioner's other point, it is one fascinating data point that I see is in some of the states where PURPA activity has been highest, you see strange fissures erupting between sort of big-scale utility, big-scale independent developers of renewable generation and the subset of QF developers. And Colorado is a good example of that, where the utility went through a big competitive solicitation to try to get more wind and other renewables on its system. They got some real rock-bottom prices out of it. Some of the projects ended up working. Some of them did not. In any case, the prices that came in were pretty low. And then the set of QF developers, again, also working on the same fuel source, wind, raised their hand and said, no, we're entitled to an earlier vintage of avoided cost forecast by the regulator that forecasts a much higher price. So even though you tested the market in a much more direct way by putting out a competitive solicitation, you still had these people arguing for this PURPA entitlement. And, you know, that is, again, there we can talk about how to improve competitive solicitations and make them more genuine and legitimate all day long. We should. But it's crazy to have PURPA be this crutch that relies so much on administrative price forecasting, which, again, is the central tendency of utility regulation itself, and which is wrong.
Travis brought up the Colorado situation, and I think Idaho was, or not Idaho, PacifiCorp, I think, and I can't remember which state it was in, was another one that the NARUC white paper discussed and was kind of typical of this, what I would call gaming of the system, where you may have project developers that have relatively large projects that go through some sort of competitive RFP process, are not selected for some perhaps very legitimate reason. Some has to do with cost, some energy versus capacity, some locationally there may be better options for consumers, but then once not selected, can disaggregate their projects into a large number of 79.5 megawatt projects, which look an awful lot like the maybe, you know, 250 or 500 or 1,000 megawatt project that they had originally proposed, and then cram it in as a PURPA enforceable obligation. It's one of the examples of gaming that can go on. And one part of the rule that FERC did address that maybe curbs some of these abuses, although I have some concerns they could have put a little bit more teeth into it, perhaps, is the disaggregation rule. Where at least there is now an ability for projects that have disaggregated beyond a mile to challenge that and to be able to prove that, no, in fact, it's still one project just disaggregated in such a way as to game the system and make them look like a number of QFs.
Let's go to the next caller.
Well, thanks for taking my question, which is, how do these changes or any future PURPA change impact executed QF contracts? So meaning, can a contracted project be immediately impacted or only after its PPA ends and recontracting comes up?
The way FERC addressed that is they grandfathered in existing legally enforceable obligations, and then on a going forward basis, I think someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but based on some date, based on when the rule is formally adopted, publication in the Federal Register, then it will apply to, or state commissions will have the flexibility to implement pricing flexibility along the lines of what's contemplated in the new rule. And then presumably as older projects roll off of their existing contracts, they would be, well, either they won't re-up, or if they do, it would be under the new rulemaking regime.
That's my understanding, too.
Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry for my ignorance of the statute, but I'm just curious, you know, so the title of the program was Retooling Energy Regulations, Who Decides? And I wonder if the commission under the statute would have the authority to basically push it entirely to state public utility commissions. I mean, you know, in the spirit of federalism and trying to get, you know, get these costs closer to political accountability. If you can't achieve a fully market-based solution, it seems like public utility commissions are pretty responsive to consumer pressures, maybe less removed than layers of bureaucracy through FERC. So I would just be interested in your response to that prospect.
Yeah, there was an intriguing proposal that I'll let Travis explain in more detail since he helped develop it, but it was the NARUC yardstick proposal, which would have done something along those lines, where state commissions would have had, given certain assumptions, for example, a transparent RFP process, maybe administered by a third-party administrator, so that you have aspects of competitive pressures built into that. If a project came through that sort of integrated resource planning process, then it could alleviate some of these PERP obligations in the same way that utilities operating within fully organized RTOs have their obligations relieved above a certain point. But I'll let Travis explain a little bit more about that proposal. It wasn't entirely adopted by the commission.
Yeah, thanks for the shout out, Tony. So what NARUC had proposed, and I co-authored this white paper, was to, I guess I would say, fully and properly implement the amendments to PERPA of EP Act 05. And what that law did is specify three categories of, realizing that the electricity markets had evolved, it specified three categories of market change that, if they had occurred, could qualify for a full exemption from the mandatory purchase obligation under PERPA. And a couple of those categories described what we now call RTOs. But then there was one of these, you know, peculiar subsection C's that said, you know, other markets of comparable competitive quality. And no one, and really it falls on FERC to explain, I think, what that means, since Congress had some reason for writing it. FERC has never really explained what you could do short of joining an RTO to trigger that provision of statute. And so NARUC proposed that it was time to create a yardstick to basically signal to Western states and those Southeastern states that had not yet joined an RTO and may never join an RTO, what they could do in terms of bulk power procurements of energy and capacity to satisfy the comparable competitive quality requirement of EP Act 05. And FERC basically took a pass. Instead of saying these, you know, they did spell out some principles for competitive solicitations, as I said before, as a way of complying with states coming up with the quote unquote right avoided cost. But that's an act that keeps their fingers in the pie of PERPA implementation. And I think a more robust way of fulfilling Congress's purpose would be for FERC to take a hard look at that, at some of the issues, come up with a yardstick, allow states and utilities and QFs and other independent power producers to think how they could work toward meeting that yardstick in their own way. And then FERC at some point simply calling the game, declaring those utilities exempt from PERPA and sending people home to the states to go about their business. But that isn't what FERC did. It was a bit disappointing. They did not close the door fully. They basically said, you know, that any utility could come to them with a petition making a showing that they met the sort of ambiguous standards under that subsection and try to obtain an exemption. And maybe some of them will, because even after this reform is implemented, PERPA implementation is going to take up a huge amount of time, and there's going to be a huge amount of back and forth between, you know, states and the FERC. So, you know, to be seen whether utilities try to make that pitch. But I agree with the questioner. There were opportunities where you could have drawn sort of a clearer line, and where PERPA issues wouldn't constantly have to recirculate back to Washington to receive a determination.
Well, Adam, it doesn't look like we have any more callers in the queue. Do you have a final angle you'd like to tackle, or any concluding thoughts from either of our experts?
Thanks, Greg. I did have one question, and there's a previous teleform where we had talked about the new NEPA reforms, and some have claimed that the great weakness of this rulemaking is that the agency did not do a NEPA analysis before it issued the PERPA rulemaking. Indeed, Commissioner Glick's dissent on the rulemaking expressly called out the lack of a NEPA analysis. Do you agree or disagree that the agency should have done a NEPA analysis? What are the pros and cons of not doing a NEPA analysis? And, you know, does it matter to the ultimate benefits or detriments of the rule?
Sure. So
yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Okay, sure. So my gut reaction, quite candidly, when I heard the NEPA argument is I probably rolled my eyes just a little bit. It seems like a bit of a long shot to me, being that this is really just an update of an existing rule. But, I mean, beyond that, could it have some legs? I don't know. I mean, that sort of line of attack is that there have been other issues where someone has raised a party has raised a procedural type objection like that. And if you get in a particular venue or a particular judge really wants to decide in a, they'll sometimes take up arguments that I think are a little off the wall. And candidly, the environmental movement's been pretty successful in, at least in certain cases in recent years, of raising some arguments and objections and being able to draw out and block projects or at least defeat through delay projects by raising some kind of tangential arguments sometimes that maybe in previous years wouldn't have been taken as seriously, but a particular venue gets selected and it goes up on that particular issue. So my gut reaction is I don't sense that this needed a NEPA review, and FERC did address that issue in the order, but you just never know when some of these things get litigated given the state of the courts today.
Yeah, if judicial review of this regulation turns on NEPA, we're all the worse for it. I guess would be my instant take. You've just heard an hour of Tony and I, you know, politely agreeing and disagreeing and amicably talking about the merits of this policy decision. And it really would be a shame if we have a system that seemingly decides all questions on whether or not someone has produced a voluminous report that few, if any, people read or candidly take very seriously, which is, I think, what a NEPA report on PURPA would really, in effect, amount to. You know, the people arguing this do have a good point. I mean, they point out that FERC, when it first implemented the 1980s rules, did a NEPA analysis. They cite to an administrative regulation at FERC that seems to suggest a NEPA analysis is required. FERC probably would have been on firmer ground had it done a NEPA analysis. But the reality is, taken at FERC's word, that it's merely making changes to rate making in a way that shouldn't affect overall adoption of renewables onto the system. And again, it's a false assumption that QFs instantly mean renewables, but let's just take FERC at their word that then really NEPA and its major impact on the human environment language probably should not be triggered. But it definitely is something that people have seized on as a weak point. It's clear just reading the commission's order and Commissioner Glick's dissent back and forth that if it was a topic they thought they might be stumbling over. And so it'll be interesting to see the litigation angles on that.
Well, Tony and Travis, thank you both so much for lending us your time and expertise to discuss this new PURPA rule and the important implications and impacts it may have. I'll give the last word to each of you. Do you have any closing remarks, any brief closing remarks?
No, just thank you for the opportunity to be here and for FedSoc for hosting this. It's been a good discussion. And in closing, I just say that, you know, I congratulate FERC for taking up this project and making a decision on it. It took a while to get there, but I think where they got was generally a pretty good place. And coming out of it, the big winners, I think if you were tallying winners in a rulemaking like this is consumers who will have some ability to have a better level of protection by their state commissions being given the opportunity to flexibly address some of these issues that have arisen out of PURPA, given the state of where it's evolved over the last 40-some years.
And I'll just conclude by saying that Tony and Adam and Federal Society, I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope everyone has a pleasant rest of the week.
Thank you so much. Thank
you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.